Doug Ritter.
Thank you, Ed. Okay. As Ed mentioned, for those of you who don't know me, Equipped to Survive is sort of like Consumer Reports for survival gear. We look at what works and what doesn't and try to convince folks that they should get stuff that works. We publish a website, equipped.org, which I hope you'll stop by if you're not familiar with. Today's presentation is What Price Your Life? Distress Alerting as a Commercial Service. Search and Rescue's traditional frame of reference, what they work around, could be summed up by the motto, that others may live. When traditional search and rescue, when traditional distress alerting services calculate their return on investment, what they're looking at is how many lives have we saved? You know, this is what most of us grew up with. This is how we approach our business. Commercial distress alerting has a different frame of reference. Put crudely, it's all about the dollars. Nobody would get into a business, even if it's a business of saving lives, unless they were planning on making money. Okay? That isn't necessarily a bad thing. I need to stress that I'm not opposed to businesses making a profit. I enjoy making one on occasion myself. Okay? I am not opposed to commercial distress alerting in the least. I think that commercial distress alerting can offer a number of advantages, and we're already seeing it in those that are there and those that are coming online in the near term. First and foremost is innovation. Without the strictures of regulation and that sort of thing, they are free to try new things, to expand their horizons, to offer their consumer more options. Innovation is generally good. So that's a positive. The other positive is pricing, because they want to be competitive, and because they're going to have to be competitive not only with traditional distress alerting, but also others coming on board in the commercial distress alerting world, the price of distress alerting is coming down, at least as it appears to the consumer. So the initial outlay is, generally speaking, going to be less expensive. Or the outlay is going to be similar, but they're going to get more for their money. So both of those things are good things. I'm not opposed to commercial distress alerting. There are some issues. I am a consumer advocate. Okay? My job is to look out for the oftentimes naive survivor who purchases these products and expects them to save their life, because that's what he's being sold. The issues that I have, and I think many in the traditional SAR community have, all revolve around managing expectations, both societal expectations and consumer expectations. So let's take a look at those. Where do those expectations come from? Well, they start out with the performance that we already get from existing COSTASAR SAT distress alerting equipment. 406 megahertz PLBs, EPIRBs, ELTs. We know how well they work. We know they save lots of lives. We know they are a robust piece of equipment. We also know and expect that these are integrated with a SAR response that starts at the national level, can go international when it has to, can go local when it's necessary. How else are their expectations arise? Through marketing and promotion. When commercial distress alerting starts promoting their products as life-saving products, that hype needs to be measured against the reality. Well, it's not marketing's job. It's not a salesman's job, necessarily, to tell everybody what the negatives, what the shortcomings of their product are. The only time that happens is when a company gets sued and has to, or when regulators tell them they have to. Otherwise, marketing's job is to sell more products, and they're going to do that as effectively as they can. One way they do that is using what I call shock and scare tactics. You know, convince somebody that they're in danger and this will save their lives, they'll buy your product. Okay. All of these together mean that the consumer's expectations of what this product will deliver are pretty high. You know, he expects, press a button, I'm going to get rescued. Talk a little bit about societal expectations. These are fed by traditional search and rescue and emergency services commitment. You know, that whole saving lives is a priority. Okay. Even in situations where you have volunteer or paid emergency services, the priority, either by tradition or by regulation, is always save lives. That is how society expectations have been built. Our society expects if you're in the business of saving lives, of selling products to save lives, that that is your priority. So back to the original question, what price your life? You know, instead of giving away this distress alerting service, somebody wants to charge you for it. Traditionally, it appears that most of those involved in this are going towards some sort of subscription-based service. You know, it's the old razor blade sort of marketing. You know, we'll sell you a product, relatively inexpensive, and hope keep paying us every year, whatever, for this service. That is a perfectly valid business model. There's nothing wrong with that. The question is, the problem arises, what happens when the money flow stops or is interrupted? Or appears to be interrupted? When I talk to people in the commercial distress alerting world about this, you know, my question is, if something goes hiccups, if they quit paying, but somebody presses that button, does the victim live or die? I can categorize the responses in two ways. One is, it's not our problem. If they pay money, we'll save them. If they didn't pay the money, don't worry about it. They can die. We don't care. We're not in the business of saving people who don't pay us. From a technical legal standpoint, that may be very true. Where that stands in the moral compass of things, I'm not so sure. So we have that response. We also have the response of it won't happen. When I ask people, well, what happens if their credit card goes expired? Oh, well, that won't happen. We'll keep after it. Well, what happens if the computer has a glitch? Oh, well, that will never happen. Excuse me? The computer will never have a glitch. So there's no possibility that, you know, some errant neuron or electrons won't go astray and my subscription is lost, and therefore when I press the button, someone's going to decide, well, he's not paid up. We're not going to come get it. You know, when those things happen, this is the result. Okay? Does someone die is the question. If someone dies, this no longer meets societal expectations for a distress alerting device. And that has repercussions, which I'll go into shortly. Let's talk about the consumer expectations. Those are filled with the current contrast RSAT distress signaling devices, which you're all familiar with. We know how they work. We know how well they do. There's legislated regulation regarding those devices and the service that's provided concurrent with them. There are standards for performance, user interface, and construction to ensure that those devices will likely work when called upon to save a life. And there is an established search and rescue interface that those devices are designed to work with. When one of those things goes off, when your PLD goes off, it goes to NOAA, it goes up to the satellite, it comes down to Earth. In the U.S., NOAA issues its SIP. Okay? This is all organized. Everybody knows their part. And that's how we get the good results that we've come to expect from these devices. Commercial distress alerting, I like to say, is like the Wild Wild West. You know, there are no regulations, really, that are specific to distress alerting. Sure, the FCC regulates it as a perhaps a radio device or a satellite modem or something like that. There are no specific standards for either performance, user interface, or construction. That doesn't mean that the manufacturer can't build it to some specification, but it also means he's not required to. Cabot Enzor, the buyer needs to be aware. Who's going to tell him if this is a good device or a bad device? And finally, there is no standardized interface with the search and rescue community for these devices. And I would like to emphasize for those who are here who are from the commercial distress alerting world that PSAP is not search and rescue. 9/11 is not search and rescue. Sometimes it is, but it's certainly not guaranteed to be, and in many areas of the country it decidedly is not. You know, you don't dial 911 if you want search and rescue. The current search and rescue infrastructure that uses the 406 beacons is built around knowing who to call. So that's a potential expectation that they do not necessarily fill. There are the subscription issues, which we've talked about. There is the question of lives versus dollars. Where does the priorities lie? And finally, there are some lessons to be learned from the way current paid commercial emergency services work. For example, in my community, we have paid ambulance, we have paid fire service in many of the areas. Okay. They have come up with a business model that allows them to put the priority on saving lives and still make a buck. Okay, so there are certainly business models out there for these commercial distress alerting services to look at and learn from. What comes next? Well, the commercial distress alerting services have two choices. They can be reactive. In other words, they don't really have to do anything at the moment. And I've had them tell me, why would we do something? There are no restrictions on us. We can do whatever we want. We can sell lots of product. That's what we're in business for. And that's true. You got to be careful what you wish for. Okay? There are unintended consequences sometimes from taking this laissez-faire attitude towards business. What happens when somebody dies because your business model put them in a difficult circumstance that they didn't survive from? What happens when those electrons go astray and the guy who had paid you to get him rescued doesn't, and he dies? I don't think everyone's just going to sit there and say, oh well, this is what causes legislation, knee-jerk reactions from regulators, and other not necessarily desirable things. But if you don't do anything, that's what's going to happen sooner or later. It's just inevitable. You know, if you don't learn from history, you're going to repeat history. And we have seen this happen time and time again in all sorts of industries. When the industry has decided that they didn't need to police themselves, they didn't need to organize themselves, and somebody got hurt. A lot of what we do here at RTCM is the result of those lessons learned. The alternative is to become proactive. Don't wait for this big hammer to fall on your head and then have to deal with it. Get the priorities straight. Figure out how to make money while putting saving lives your number one priority. I'm convinced it can be done. Put together a business group or a voluntary group of people to work up standards so you have a means of saying, my product meets a standard that the community has decided is adequate. And that ensures more consistent interfaces, better products, more robust products. Work on interfacing with the existing government search and rescue interface. They'd be happy to work with you, I'm sure, because their business is saving lives. If you contact the right person at the right time, you're going to save more lives than if you just dial 911. That is my message. Get ahead of this problem. Develop standards. Work with the current infrastructure. Or somebody is going to make you do it anyway, and you're probably going to not like how they do that. Time is not your friend in this. Time to jump on this problem before it becomes bigger. That's it.